You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Feeling stuck in your job? Bank of America's The Academy for Consumer and Small Business helps you develop a long-term career path. Through peer mentorship, immersive programs, and a variety of clear and distinct paths, you can reach the next level in your career. Take your first step towards a long-term career path at careers.bankofamerica.com. And now, on with the show. Hi. I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. Adventurer and explorer Josh Gates has spent his career crossing the globe to investigate the world's most intriguing mysteries. He hosted 5 seasons of Travel Channel's Destination Truth, on which he investigated cryptoid creatures and things that go bump in the night, from hiking the Himalayas in search of the Yeti to trolling the Amazon for giant anacondas. More recently, as host of Discovery Channel's Expedition Unknown, he's returned to his roots as an archaeologist, heading to the farthest reaches of the Earth to explore legends that have remained unsolved for centuries. He's dived the Caribbean for sunken pirate treasure and followed the trail of stolen Nazi gold. He's hacked his way through the remote jungles of Cambodia in search of the real Temple of Doom, and braved the Kalahari Desert looking for a legendary lost city. Last season, he even unsealed an Egyptian tomb for the first time in 3,000 years on a live television event. Now Josh is back for the 7th season of Expedition Unknown, and today Josh joins me on the show to talk about it. Josh tells me even in the age of Google Maps, there are still unexplored parts of the world full of mystery. This self-described open-minded skeptic talks about his obsession with the abominable snowman and speculates on why mystery primates like the Yeti and the Sasquatch appear time and again in cultures all over the world. He reveals how Expedition Unknown helped recover Judy Garland's stolen ruby slippers from the Wizard of Oz, new forensic evidence he found in the case of D.B. Cooper, and recent developments that led him to revisit several topics in the new season. Josh shares some of his other adventures this season, from braving the Siberian winter to look into the bizarre Dyatlov Pass incident, to scouring the ancient caves of Israel and Jordan for the lost Dead Sea Scrolls. He describes how he decides which legends to chase, which ones are too dangerous, how to handle a shakedown by local authorities, and the most awkward of all conversations, how to divvy up a treasure. Coming up with Josh Gates in just a moment. Josh Gates is an ardent explorer and adventurer who has traveled to the ends of the earth investigating the greatest legends in history. He's the host of Discovery Channel's Expedition Unknown, which chronicles Gates' adventures as he sets out on a global journey to find the truth behind captivating and iconic unsolved legends, from the disappearance of Amelia Earhart to the fabled crystal skulls of Doom, the Dead Sea Scrolls, and even diving the Great Lakes in search of the holy grail of lost American shipwrecks. Season 7 of Expedition Unknown is currently airing Wednesdays at 8, 9 Central on Discovery. Josh Gates, welcome to the podcast.
Happy to be here. How are you, man?
I'm fantastic. Now, I have to confess to you, I'm a little new to Expedition Unknown.
Fair enough. You're forgiven.
I actually got into it because of my father-in-law. He's a fan of the show. He likes, and I do too, like these kind of mystery shows, you know, searching for lost things in history and that kind of thing. And for some reason, I don't know where he gets this from, but he thinks that you remind me of him. That you remind him of me, or I remind him of you. I don't know, one way or another.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Other than the beard, I don't know if I see that.
You and I have got a similar look going on.
Yeah, well, I would take that as an insult if I were you. But
not at all.
Yeah, but I think it's also a personality thing, because I guess he thinks that you're pretty goofy on the show sometimes.
That's a fair assessment, I would say.
That's a sense of humor about what you're doing.
Yes, we don't take ourselves too seriously.
Yeah. So, yeah, I guess it wasn't that long ago, maybe a few weeks back, that he took me and my wife and made us sit down and watch, I want to say it was the Jean Lafitte episode.
Yeah, well, first of all, I love your father-in-law. Oh, this guy's great. He's forcing forcing you to watch my show. I got to hire this guy.
Yeah.
My new publicist.
Yeah. Well, he's a big fisherman. So if you ever have a Loch Ness Monster expedition or something like that, yeah, he's your guy.
Cool.
Yeah. And I love the Lafitte one because, you know, aside from the fact that I just love New Orleans and I especially love, what is it, Lafitte's Blacksmith Shop
Bar. The darkest bar in America, I always say.
Yeah.
I mean, you need a headlamp to get from the bar to a table in there. It is pitch black.
I've been going to New Orleans for, God, I don't know how many years. And every time I go back, I keep thinking, there's no way this is going to be standing. It looks like the stiff breeze would blow it over.
It barely is standing, it seems like. But it's been there for ages. I mean, it lays claim. I don't know if it's a dubious claim or not, but they say it's the oldest bar in America.
Is that true?
That's what they say.
That's what they claim.
I mean, it makes sense. That's a sign I feel like I've seen in a few bars, though.
Now, what is the one in New York? McSorley's?
That's right.
Don't they also claim to be the oldest bar in America?
So I think there's like lots of versions of this. Some of them are getting by on oldest operating. Some of them are getting by on when it was first a bar.
Yeah.
You know, things like that.
Yeah.
Lafitte's is – that place is amazing. No trip to the French Quarter is complete without ending up in there stumbling around in the dark.
Now, I read that you actually do have a degree in archaeology as well as in drama, apparently. So Expedition Unknown is kind of a perfect fit for you, huh?
Yeah, it's like I in high school got interested in drama toward the end of high school, got into acting, went to college, had this real love of history, and so ended up double majoring in drama and archaeology to the complete dismay of my parents, you know, the two lowest earning professions. Maybe a, you know... an English literature degree would have been, you know, rounded it out. But, you know, they were like, what would you ever do with this?
Yeah.
And I had no idea what I would do with it, really. I loved archaeology. I loved marine archaeology. I thought maybe I'd go into underwater archaeology. My father was a commercial deep sea diver for his whole career. He had this really adventurous career as a diver. So loved the ocean.
What was he looking for? Like salvage?
He did everything. He did salvage. You know, he did oil. He did... you know, oil and gas stuff. He kind of did it all over the course of his career. But from a really early age, I was, I think I was scuba diving when I was like 9, you know, so really, really young.
Wow. Yeah.
And so, and we grew up by the ocean. And so I thought I'd go into underwater archaeology and then kind of thought, well, I spent a couple of years chasing the drama side of things. And it never occurred to me to try to put those two things together. I mean, it really didn't. Like years went by. And then I had an opportunity to host a pilot of a travel adventure show, and then for some reason I was like, why didn't I do this a long time ago?
What show was that? Was that
Destination Truth?
Okay.
Yeah.
And you had a good run there. Like how many seasons did we do? We did five seasons
of that on Sci-Fi. And that came about because Ghost Hunters, which is coming back again, but Ghost Hunters was really like the big paranormal hit on Sci-Fi at that time. And they really wanted a sister act for that show, something that could sit alongside it in like the 10 o'clock hour, and they had tried a few different things that hadn't worked, and they met this producer and he sold them on the idea for this show Destination Truth, which was, you know, it was kind of like an Ooga Booga monsters and ghosts
like
kind
crypto of thing. Zoology,
yeah,
right?
It was crypto stuff and weird, you know, lake monsters and but mostly far flung stuff, you know, developing nations, half a world away kind of stuff. And they shot a pilot and they didn't like the host they had. And so this guy, this producer said, you know, you should meet my friend Josh. He's a travel nut. Because I was already traveling quite a bit. You know, I was living in L.A., waiting tables, make a little money, take a little trip. You know, I'd make a little money.
So you've always had the travel bug.
I've always had the travel bug.
That's cool.
And so it all kind of came together.
Yeah, I mean, what is an audition for a show like Expedition Unknown like? I mean, do they send you in the desert and see if you come back alive, or do they give you like 5 days to find a crystal skull?
Exactly.
Like, what
is that? Well, for Destination Truth, which is really where it started, you know, I got this email. I was overseas, actually. I was in Africa doing Kilimanjaro in Tanzania with two buddies of mine. And I got an email from this producer that I knew. And he said, you know, you've got to come back to L.A. I have this opportunity for you. And, of course, if you live in L.A., people say things like that a lot, right? So you go, yeah, sure you do. And I finished up my trip. I wasn't going to fly home on a whim. And so when I came back, this producer was just hounding me. Mm-hmm. And he said, Are you back yet? And I said, I just landed at LAX. And he said, come to my office right now. And so I drove to his office from the airport. And I'd been in Africa for like a month. And I looked awful. I had like a huge beard and a neck beard, you know, like one of those Civil War. You know, really let yourself go beards. My clothes were filthy.
Yeah.
Dirty Ebola. Safari shirt. Yeah. I had Ebola, full Ebola. I was a mess. And I stank. I mean, I literally stank. And I came into his office and he said, look, I've sold this premise for this show to Sci-Fi and they need a host. And tomorrow you're going to go over there and meet with them, and I want you to come just like this. Don't shower, don't shave, don't change your clothes, sleep in your boots. Come to the meeting just like this. And I was stupid, so I said, yeah, okay, sure, yeah, you know. And I kept saying to him, like, what is this show? And he's, you're going to go hunt monsters. And I was like, I don't really, like, am I qualified to hunt? I have an undergraduate degree in archaeology.
Yeah, do qualifications exist in that field?
Right, like I'm picturing Van Helsing. Like, yeah. I need a crossbow and a trench coat. I'm like, I don't know if I'm really built for this.
Yeah.
And so the next day, I went over to Sci-Fi, which at that time was in the big Universal Tower.
I used to have an office there. Yeah, I remember that.
It's this, and for those of you listening who don't know, it's this like really imposing, stark-looking building.
Yeah, it's a monolith.
Yeah, exactly. It's a very uninviting-looking place. And so I went in there, and I literally did. I wore all my same stuff, and I stank. And I looked like a homeless guy. And I walked in, and they, like, in the front, like, giving my ID, they were kind of looking at me like, is this dude going to like pee on the rug? Like, what, you know? And they let me in and I went up to the Sci-Fi offices, which I remember were like this gleaming white space dock. It was like a set from 2001.
Oh, wow.
And I felt even dirtier, you know, being in this lobby. And what I didn't know is that they had actually narrowed it down to a few other guys, that they had gone and done a casting and just agreed to meet this producer's buddy. You know, they'd agreed to meet me, but they had, you know, done a proper casting. And so there was like three other guys there and they were, you know, showered. they didn't have neck beards.
Yeah.
You know, they weren't suffering from full blown Ebola. And so I was I felt really humiliated. Yeah, I really just was like, this was such a mistake. I looked like such a goon. And they marched these guys down the hall one at a time. And then finally they called me down last and I went into this little room and there were all these executives in there, way more people than I thought there were going to be in this room. And they all just kind of leaned back when I walked in like, oh, there's a homeless guy in the room. He's broken into the building.
Yeah.
And I just felt like I had to apologize like out of the gate, you know. And I said, hey, everybody, you know, let me just before we get started, I just want to apologize for my appearance. I just got off a plane from Tanzania and that was it.
Did they think you were full of shit?
No, that was it. Like that whole like dress for the job you want.
Yeah,
it works both ways. If you dress shitty enough, they will let you hunt for monsters on TV. That's all I said. I'm sorry. I just got off a plane from Tanzania. The other guys were wearing suits. They looked like game show hosts, you know.
Yeah,
and I think that they just in that moment they were like, yeah, this is a guy who likes to go travel and is game for anything, I guess.
Yeah.
And so that was it. And we went and shot a pilot, and that turned into a series. And, of course, at every step of the way, I was like, this will never turn into something. And it just kind of snowballed from there.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Now, this new show, or relatively new show, seven seasons now, Expedition Unknown, is a little more rooted in reality. You're searching for things that may have really existed at some point or another, as opposed to doing cryptozoology and hunting down the Loch Ness Monster or whatever. But I want to say that I saw somewhere along the way here that you're doing an episode on Chupacabra,
right? We are doing a Chupacabra show, yeah. I mean, look, Expedition Unknown really grew out of, as we traveled around the world making Destination Truth, I got really interested in a lot of the real history that was going on in the places we were visiting. And I've always had a love of archaeology. And so I really wanted to do a show that was more rooted in real historic mysteries. But the show still does have a lot of legends and it has a lot of There's a lot of folklore and mythology floating around the edges, but we try to look at everything through a historic lens. You know, we did a show this year on the Crystal Skull of Doom, which is, you know, this very famous and controversial artifact that, if you believe the story, came from a Maya ruin, you know, in Belize. And if you don't believe the story, it was a hoax that was...
Or if you believe Indiana Jones, it was aliens, right?
Or it was aliens, exactly. That's the Indiana Jones film we don't talk about.
Yeah, exactly.
But it was the inspiration for the fourth Indiana Jones film. And look, this is a dubious artifact, but that's part of the show, you know. And so for me, look, it was even true on Destination Truth. Whether I believed that a lake monster was plaguing some village, I believe that these people saw something, that they genuinely were terrified by something. Now, it might be a case of misidentification. It might be a case of, you know, folklore and folkloric belief. But there's a real story. So same's true with the Chupacabra, right? I think one of the reasons we wanted to do a Chupacabra story is that it started in Puerto Rico in 95. A lot of people think it was a Mexico thing.
Yeah, I always assumed that.
Yeah, no, it started in Puerto Rico, and it's back. You know, that's the headline.
It's back. Gone for a while?
He was gone. It happened in 95. It was this big worldwide phenomenon. Yeah. It kind of jumped the island and reports in Mexico and all over Latin America and Texas. And then it became like a pop culture phenomenon, and now there are livestock killings again in Puerto Rico.
As of when?
As of late last year.
So there's been kind of a new... I can posit a theory. Okay, yes. Remember when in India they had all the blackouts and everyone started saying there's a monkey man running all over?
Yes.
Maybe the storms and the fact that the power's out and nothing's really working there fuels conspiracy theories and
sightings. I don't know that you're
so
wrong
forth.
Because the first sightings were also tied around... a big weather event and hurricanes and stuff as well. So you might be onto something.
Huh.
But what I love about the Chupacabra is that you can be a total skeptic, right? I'm a skeptic. But there's a body count. There's a bunch of dead animals that have weird bite marks to the neck. That's real. So I just love it when there's a story.
Yeah.
Like I don't have to go all in on Creature X.
Yeah.
There's a mystery. There's a real mystery. So I'm in. You know, I'm interested.
Now, does it just eat goats? Because Chupacabra translates to goaty. Is it strictly a goatitarian, or does it do chicken and pork?
No. The name means goat sucker.
Yeah.
But a lot of chickens as well.
Okay.
The occasional sheep, but it's mostly goats and chickens.
So you're pretty much, you say, a skeptic initially when you come into these things. You're not a true believer.
I'm not a true believer. I always say I'm an open-minded skeptic.
Okay.
You know, I think. Look, one of the things that really I think I learned on Destination Truth is that it's easy to hear some of these stories and kind of laugh at them or dismiss them out of hand. What I really learned on that show, though, is that often these stories are really interesting cultural fingerprints for the places that you're going.
Yeah.
Like the Yeti's a great example, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Okay, on face value, kind of silly, right? Giant, mysterious primate lurking around the high Himalayas. Sounds like something out of a, you know, Hollywood yarn. But you go up into the Himalayas and you talk to people and they have a real reverence for the Yeti. You know, they have a real connection to that story, and they talk about it in a way that isn't silly, you know. And one of the things that you learn when you start to hear about the Yeti is a real similarity in the reports. So people will say the Yeti, you know, if you don't farm your land right, the Yeti will come and take your sheep.
So there's a moral component.
Yes,
to this
exactly.
As well.
Right. So if you don't treat the land a certain way, the Yeti will come. And the same thing is true of other creatures around the world. There's a creature in the Amazon called the Mapinguari in the Brazilian Amazon. And rubber tree workers would say, if you cut down too many rubber trees, the Mapinguari will come and take you. Or villagers would tell little kids around the fire, you know, if you go too far out into the jungle, the Mapinguari will come and take you. And one of the things that some of these stories might be a kind of oral version of environmentalism, you know.
Yeah.
In the Himalayas, the mountains are very dangerous. You know, you're living in an environment that can kill you. And so to give that environment a face, to give it a name, to say you have to respect this place or it will come and eat you, is really interesting. So I've kind of learned... Huh. I'm not a true believer in these things necessarily as biological, you know, boogeymen running around, but I think every story is important if somebody takes the time to tell it.
Well, yeah, and the thing that's interesting to me is that every culture in the world seems to have these two things that come up over and over again, lake monsters and these mystery primates like Bigfoot or the Yeti. And the thing that I always wonder is, do we take all of those reports as validation that maybe these cryptoid creatures exist? Or is it more like a Joseph Campbell type of thing in the sense that there are certain archetypes that are just universal, even when it comes to monsters?
I think it's the latter. Mm-hmm. I think in the case of lake monsters, some of it is just lakes and bodies of water are dark and scary and things live inside of them. And we see only glimpses of what's down there and it spooks us out. I mean, I think some of it is as simple as that.
Right.
You know,
the same reason we fear ghosts when it's dark at night and that kind of
thing. That's right. Yeah. When it comes to the mystery primates, though, I think it is something much more profound. And I think it is this Joseph Campbell sort of idea, which is like almost every culture in the world has a version of Bigfoot. And isn't that weird? You know, isn't that strange that we all kind of have this idea, this fascination of a kind of primal version of ourselves living out in the wilderness? And what does that say about us? You know, to me, that's a fascinating question. And I think we often talk about Bigfoot and the other end of the spectrum, which is just this, is it real? Isn't it real? Kind of argument.
Yeah.
But I think it's fascinating, this idea that we have these stories collectively.
Yeah.
You know, as a species that we're interested in.
Yeah. Well, I mean, everyone wants to know where we come from.
Sure.
I wonder, of all the crypto creatures rumored to exist around the world, do you have a particular obsession? Is there one that's your white whale, I guess?
It's the Yeti.
It's the Yeti?
I love the Yeti. You know, I probably brought it up for that very reason. You know, I love the Himalayas. I love the people there. I love it's funny. I'm not that into Bigfoot.
Oh, yeah?
But there's something sort of romantic to me about the idea of this solitary creature living up in the high snow-capped peaks.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's something just cool about it.
Yeah.
If I could wish one creature into existence, it would be the Yeti.
Well, you know, my thing with, I guess, not just shows like yours, like Expedition Unknown or Destination Truth, but any of these shows where it's like, okay, did Hitler run off to Argentina, or what's at the bottom of the Oak Island hole and all that stuff is, I always think to myself, okay, if they really discovered this stuff, I wouldn't be finding out on the show. This would have been front page news on the New York Times long before it ever made the air, right? I mean, are there ever big breaking news discoveries on a show?
Yeah, we've had that happen a couple times on Expedition Unknown. We did a story on D.B. Cooper, the famous skyjacker.
Oh, yeah.
And we did a new series of tests on his tie, which was one of the only things he left behind in the plane.
He took his tie off before he jumped out the door?
He had a clip-on tie, and it got left behind. And it's one of the only physical pieces of evidence. And we worked with some investigators, and they found new rare earth elements on the tie, something called yttrium, which was used in only a really limited number of industries at that time. So it provides a really interesting snapshot of – now, that's assuming that D.B. Cooper didn't take the tie from somebody else or pick it up at a flea market. I mean, assuming it was his tie, it means he, you know, would have worked in a very limited number of industries that were working with some of those rarer elements. People making high-tech screens for fighter planes and things like that.
Oh, interesting.
So
– wow.
It was a really interesting and kind of, you know, significant development. And it kind of got out ahead of the show, you know, so that does happen. And we did.
It has to be hard to keep that kind of thing under wraps.
Because it takes time to edit the show.
Right.
So if, I mean, you're kind of in trouble, right?
Yeah.
We did the same thing with, we did an episode on the Ruby Slippers, which was a kind of a weird episode for Expedition Unknown, but also really fun. You know, there were like four pairs of Ruby Slippers from the Wizard of Oz.
Right.
And one's in the Smithsonian and a couple of are privately owned. And one pair was stolen. And it's like the most valuable Hollywood artifact that ever got stolen. And so we did a whole show on the hunt for the missing Ruby Slippers, and then they found them.
Where did they find them?
That's a good question that nobody's ever really
given. Oh, really?
The FBI had a big press conference, and that they said I think they were returned anonymously because they didn't make an arrest. And so I think the FBI was a little like, you know, it didn't look that good because they didn't really have somebody to – you know, pin up for it. Yeah, exactly. So we had to go in and alter the show a little bit to reflect the fact that they'd been found.
Okay.
So that does happen from time to time. It's a good problem to have.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, the other thing that I have with a lot of these shows is that usually and I get that this is for dramatic effect and all that, is there's always a cliffhanger ending.
Sure.
You know, it's never like, okay, we found the Ark of the Covenant. It's usually, well, there are enough clues that we can leave it open that this could be possible. But I think in this season, you're actually returning to some of the subjects that you've visited before.
We are.
Which ones are you going back to? And can I take that to mean that there's some new developments on those?
There are, yeah. So first, to speak to the problem, I mean, it is a thing that happens all the time, right?
Yeah.
Every time we go to commercial.
I mean, anything on History Channel. Anything. I'm not saying it's just a
thing. It's not. It's all of us.
It is the genre.
It is the genre. So first of all, every time I go to commercial, if I go to commercial and I'm not hanging off a cliff, you know, the network is like, people might leave. They might, you know, go to that toothpaste commercial. They might leave. They might go somewhere else. So you're always being having your arm twisted a little bit to make those act breaks exciting, you know. But, you know, the other thing is I really see my job on Expedition Unknown not as going to find these things, you know? I mean, I think the idea that I'm going to go to the Holy Land for 7 days and find the Ark of the Covenant, which people have been looking for a few thousand years, it might be a little unrealistic, right? So for me, the show is about exposing people to the stories, to getting people interested and excited in the story at hand, and to showcase other explorers and archaeologists and historians that are doing really cool, badass, interesting work. You know, I think for me, I'm trying to get people excited about the idea of exploration. You know, so like if we do a show and we don't find, you know, like we did this show, one of the shows we're going to return to, for instance, is this show in Guatemala, The Hunt for the Snake Kings. And it's one of my favorite episodes we've ever done.
What are the Snake Kings?
A group of leaders that led a pre-classic Maya civilization in Guatemala. So the Maya history can be divided into the classic period and the pre-classic period.
Okay.
And the classic period of the Maya is when they built all the big cool cities like Tikal and Chichen Itza and all that stuff.
Okay.
They had a kind of version 1.0, which they call the pre-classic, and they built these really interesting and impressive cities, but the whole thing collapsed and then restarted.
Okay, so try again.
Yeah, exactly. And so the pre-classic is a much more mysterious period in Maya history. And there's a place called El Mirador, which is a huge complex of cities in the jungles of northern Guatemala.
Okay,
I've heard of it. It's an amazing place, and we went there because they've never found any of the tombs, the royal tombs, of the people of these Snake Kings, which is the name of the cult that kind of ruled this civilization. And obviously that's of great interest to the archaeologists because, you know, who are these guys? These are the big charismatic movers and shakers that organized a civilization. And so we went down there and worked with this really great archaeologist, a guy named Dr. Richard Hansen, who's been down in these jungles excavating for like 30 years. And so just to go down there to see him, to see his team, to see the work they're doing, that's that's what I'm in it for, right?
Cool.
Like I want to go show these people that are like embedded in this, you know, overgrown jungle ruins, finding this
And that's
stuff.
An insane commitment because, I mean, you kind of parachute in for like, what, a week or something.
Totally.
These guys, that's their life.
It's their life.
And the humidity and all
Exactly. So we went down there. One of the biggest finds we've ever been a part of on the show is we did a bunch of LIDAR scanning. LIDAR is this new laser mapping that's kind of revolutionizing archaeology. It finds all sorts of interesting things, especially in dense jungles. It's able to scan through jungle canopies. It's like a magic technology. And we did a bunch of laser mapping down there about a year and a half ago, and we found this whole temple complex that nobody had seen in 2,000 years.
Wow.
And so we trekked out to it and bushwhacked a path to it and saw big overgrown pyramids and temples. I mean, total
That's incredible.
Like Indiana Jones stuff. So we're going back to see Richard and his team. They have a new development at the site. They found new things. So, you know, places where there are really active excavations going on, where they're making big discoveries, those are the kind of places that we're returning to this season is to update our viewers and take them back and see what's happened since we left.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Josh Gates when we come back in just a minute. It's a new season. Antonio Brown is on the Raiders, Le'Veon Bell is with the Jets, and Odell Beckham is in Cleveland. But one thing that hasn't changed, where you should put your money down on all the games. MyBookie is the place to bet on football every weekend. MyBookie has better bonuses and more prop bets than any other sports book. This year, they're hosting the first online handicapping super contest. First place is guaranteed to win $100,000, and it only costs $100 to enter. All you gotta do is pick five NFL teams against the spread every week to climb the leaderboard and score your share of the huge cash prize pool. MyBookie has live in-game betting on every NFL game. They've got the most rewarding player perks in the business, and you can even bet the over-under on how many fantasy points a player will score each game. Join now and get up to $1,000 first deposit bonus and double your first deposit. Use promo code KICKASS to activate the offer. Visit MyBookie online today. That's MyBookie, and don't forget to use the promo code KICKASS, KICKASS, when creating your account to claim the bonus. Bet, win, get paid. You know, folks, there's a reason they made a movie about two men defying great odds to get some White Castle sliders. They really are that crave-worthy. And now you can make those same delicious sliders at home with White Castle's microwavable sliders. White Castle sliders from the grocery store have the same one-of-a-kind taste that White Castle has been serving in their restaurants for years. From their unique signature buns to their 100% beef patties, which are cooked on a bed of steamed grilled onions, these sliders come in a variety of flavors that are made to be enjoyed. Craving something spicy? The jalapeno sliders are sure to give your day that tasty kick it needs. Or if you're hungry for something a little more traditional, their cheese sliders are the perfect choice. Folks, I've been hearing about how good White Castle burgers are for my whole life. And then a few years ago, I was in Chicago one night, and I asked a buddy of mine who lives there to take me for a real White Castle experience. Believe me, I didn't have to twist his arm. White Castle burgers were his favorite treat since childhood, and he said he just about lived on them when he was in college. That's the night I got hooked on White Castle's cheese sliders. I'm not embarrassed to say I probably ate just about a dozen of them that night. There's just something so simple and satisfying about meat, cheese, and onions on a pillowy soft bun. It was a tough adjustment when I came back to California and there weren't any White Castle restaurants to be found, and believe me, I searched. But now White Castle has come to the rescue with sliders in my local grocery store. You know that White Castle burgers are iconic, and their fans like me aren't going to settle for anything less than an authentic White Castle experience. So I'm just thrilled that their microwave sliders really do live up to the name White Castle. Just 60 seconds in the microwave, and it takes me back to that night in Chicago so many years ago. They even have breakfast sliders in a variety of flavors, perfect for when you need a quick hot breakfast on the go. From the castle or the grocery store, you can satisfy your crave anytime with White Castle. Go to whitecastle.com/kick to get a dollar off the purchase of any 4 or 6-pack White Castle sliders. And now, back to the podcast. I kind of feel like in this age of Google Maps and satellites, it feels like there's just nothing new under the sun and everything that's going to be discovered has been discovered. Are there still a lot of blank spots on the map out there?
Yeah, so there are, you know, and I think that that's again, kind of getting back to like, what's it all about? Mm-hmm. For me, that's really at the core of the show, because I do think we live in a time, to your point, where people are losing a little bit their sense of imagination about the world.
Yeah.
You know, Google Maps is amazing. It's, you know, like everybody else, I use it 1,000 times a day. But there's something, you know, I ride a motorcycle as well as owning a car. And I don't have a mount on my motorcycle for my phone. And so when I have to go somewhere on my bike, I'm kind of back to the way it was just a few years ago before we all had nav systems. And
that's kind of fun.
It is fun. Yeah. It can be frustrating if you're late to go somewhere. But this sense of exploration, even just the exploration of like, you know, what block you turn on and where you go. Yeah.
Well, I worry that we're losing our sense of spatial awareness and our innate ability to find our way around a place.
I mean, we totally are, right? Yeah. We know that. It's like people are just cluelessly bumping into each other and walking into traffic, right? So, so on Expedition Unknown, you know, look, I'm not changing the world, but to the extent that I can, I love trying to show people that there is a ton of mystery left in the world. Mm-hmm. You know, and any archaeologist will tell you, you know, we've just scratched the surface of what's out there. But yes, there are places in the world even where we don't have maps. You know, you look at the deepest jungles of the Amazon, you look at parts of Peru, you know, sections of Central Africa. There are areas where you look at the best maps that are available, they're not that good. The sections of Peru,
really?
If you look at the best government topo map of like parts of Peru, there's an area that it says insufficient data. And you think, like, wait, that's
not
impossible.
Like the Area 51 of Peru,
right,
or something,
yeah,
is it?
Yeah, well, actually, it might be. But
the Nazca lines.
Yeah, exactly. but you know, there are mysteries out there to be solved. Yeah. You go to El Mirador, this Maya city in Guatemala. It's an ancient city that's the size of Los Angeles.
Wow.
I mean, it's that big.
That's huge.
And if you say to Dr. Hansen, who's been there for 30 years with a trowel in his hand, you say, how much of this have you excavated? 2%? 3%? And everywhere you look at El Mirador, you see these big hills. And you say, what's that? And he goes, well, that's a pyramid. What's that? That's a pyramid. They're
like
just waiting under the ground, you know? And
that's
so
crazy.
There are generations and generations worth of work to be done out there to understand human history. And so I hate to sort of start sounding like an old guy, like kids today and this and that, because I was a video game kid when I was a kid, and I loved screens and computers when I was a kid. But I do think we are kind of getting into dangerous territory about exploring, being out in the world doing stuff, you know? And so to the extent that I can help shine a light on other people that are doing this work. I mean, I'm not the guy digging up El Mirador. I'm going to go take you to meet that guy, you know?
Right. And I know you've worked with, what was it, Zahi Hawass
Zahi
or whatever
Hawass,
in Egypt, who's that guy is like the guy. Anytime you're doing anything archaeological, he just pops up.
Yeah, whether
you
invite him or
Egypt.
Not.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's there. No, Zahi's like Mr. Egypt, you know?
Yeah.
And he's a controversial guy, too. There are some people who say, he's, you know, too much media, too much TV.
Right.
And that. But listen, this is a guy who, like, single-handedly has done so much for Egyptian tourism.
Yeah.
And this is the big question, is like this relationship between the really important, careful academic work that is going on in terms of archaeology and the public.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to have bridges in between those two things, because what are you digging it up for if people can't consume it and digest it and understand it and be excited by it?
Yeah.
So,
and
you
I
know,
mean, it's not long, not that long ago that you had, I want to say, like, certain really far to the right segments of like the Muslim Brotherhood saying we need to tear down all these structures because they're haram, they're forbidden in the Muslim religion and all this stuff.
That's
so
right.
To have someone that like that who is actually making these public issues
that's
is
right.
pretty important, I think.
It is important. And so really, you know, for me, so much of it is about, you know, it's about the journey, it's about the exposure. I can't do the Maya world justice in 43 minutes, you know? So, you know,
but
it's
you get people interested.
That's the
crack
that's
open
the
a book afterwards.
That's
check
the
it
hope.
Out. Yeah. Dig deeper. Yeah,
totally.
Definitely. When you go to find Mayan treasure or Captain Kidd's treasure, or, you know, the other day I watched one where I didn't even know this story, but it was some kind of cult, Brother 12 in Canada, and he buried all these gold coins in jars. Do you have any kind of a deal with Discovery if you find something? Like, what's your cut? What's their cut? How does that work?
Whenever we do a show that's like non-archaeological, where it's just like treasure hunters, they're a different breed. You know, when you go out with the metal detector guys, you know, they usually bring it up. They're always like, what's going to happen if we find this jar of coin? Like, they want,
really?
Like pirates. They want to divide up the spoils before they even get to it.
Really? They bring that up with you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. What's going to happen? Yeah, I always assume if I'm out on one of those like pirate treasure shows and we find anything, I'm gonna feel the cold crack of a rock in the back of my head.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
right. No, I mean, look, for the archaeological stuff, it's obviously pretty much everywhere we go, we have zero stake in anything.
Okay.
You know, they're not gonna let me get out alive with the you know, with the Chachapoyan idol from the temple. It's not going to be mine to keep.
Yeah. And I noticed that you also do a lot of caves on this show. And I'm not talking about, like, big caves like Carlsbad Caverns, like very narrow caves where you can't move your arms and stuff. You don't get claustrophobic in that kind of situation?
You know, I have this weird, like, I guess what I'm saying is I'm stupid. But I, in the moment, it all seems like a good idea.
Uh-huh.
I get this weird, like, adrenaline, Boy Scout, like, this will be fun kind of thing. And then when I watch it later, I'm like, what was that? No, why would you go in there?
Yeah.
You know?
It all sounds good when you're at the mouth of the cave, but then we forget the cave's usually narrow.
Yeah. I mean, you do a lot of dumb things in the name of excitement.
Uh-huh.
You know, if I'm into something and there's you know, There's something in the back of that cave.
Yeah.
I'm usually in there.
Do you have a phobia? Snakes, spiders?
I hate scorpions.
Scorpions?
Yes.
That's pretty specific.
I
Do you run into a lot of those? More
yeah.
than snakes and all the other things?
Yeah.
Really?
I mean, I don't know about more than snakes, but yeah, we run into yeah. them. I hate them. I think they're like of all, I think they're from a, like a design perspective. They're just horrible. Like picture like it's this gross spiky thing with these weird
yeah.
horrible pincher claws and a tail that swings over its head.
Yeah.
To sting and it's just
multiple,
like
multiple yeah weapon systems there.
Yeah. yeah. Like it's a monster. If you blew that thing up and made it like four times as big, nobody yeah. would leave the house if
yeah.
those existed.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, they're horrible.
Yeah, and you've also had, I want to say, the same camera operator for, what, probably 10 years now? Evan Stone, right?
He always
How
makes
does he
me
handle
say,
that?
He always makes me say Evan B. Stone because there's,
oh, really?
There's a male porn star named Evan Stone.
You're kidding me.
And so his whole life, it's haunted him. So he's always says, Evan B. Stone. He's yeah. got to get that middle initial in there or the Google searches get real ugly real quick.
Is he pretty much game for anything?
Yeah, Evan is, if there's anybody who might be stupider than me, it's Evan. Evan, no, he's the best. Evan is, you know, there's that famous Ginger Rogers quote, right, that she did everything Fred Astaire did but backwards and in heels, right?
Right, yeah.
That's Evan. That's I mean, him. It's what I'm saying is he wears high heels. It's like if I'm hanging off a cliff, someone else is hanging off that cliff holding a camera.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
So the show can only happen if you've got people that can really get out there and capture what's happening. And so these guys yeah. are out in insane heat, insane cold,
wow.
slinging cameras and mics and equipment and drones. And, yeah. you know, it's a lot of work. And
yeah,
so
I'll bet.
He's been
it's harder to keep
stalwart.
Your balance with a camera in hand.
Totally. These guys yeah. got 30, 40 pounds on their shoulders sometimes.
Wow.
And in the middle of the jungle in 110 degrees. So they're the real rock stars of the show. Yeah. Evan's like this stalwart companion who's been with me for like a decade. He's just amazing.
Wow. And I think that this might have been Destination Truth, but there was one episode in a haunted forest, and I want to say Romania, where, man, poor Evan just got the scare of his life. Can you explain what happened there?
I can't explain it. I can tell you what happened. I can't yeah. explain it, though. We did a story back on Destination Truth in this haunted, purportedly haunted forest in Romania called the Hoiabachu Forest. And look, I'm a... like I've gone to lots of reportedly haunted places
mm-hmm.
and I've never seen like, you know, the specter of death, hooded figure, guy with a scythe, you know? So I'm definitely on the skeptical side of things when it comes to that after all these years. But there are places, even if you're a skeptic, there are places that you walk into that feel weird.
Yeah.
We've all felt that. There are places that just have some weird bad juju. And I don't know what it is, if it's a psychological thing, you know, but this forest in Romania is weird.
Huh.
It doesn't feel good. It's not a nice place to hang out. And we were in this forest, and there's this creepy clearing in the middle of the forest where people have seen things. And Evan was sitting in this clearing, and we weren't right around him. We were at this kind of base camp area we used to operate out of. And suddenly he got like, there's footage of it. He got flung off of his feet by something.
Wow.
And
there was nothing around him.
Nothing around
that
him.
You could tell.
And we ran wow. over to him. And I've known Evan a long time. And Evan, by the way, is a skeptic. Evan's not a uh-huh. ghost guy. He's not a paranormal dude. It's just not his thing. He was ashen. He was like emotional. He was terrified. So one of those nights where I still replay it in my mind and go, what happened there?
Yeah.
I don't know.
That is crazy.
Sometimes the world wow. is mysterious.
Now, have there ever been places that you wanted to go, but because of, I don't know, political instability or whatever, you just couldn't make it happen?
Yeah. You know, there's always a list of, like, all the stories that we want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them have been on there a long time. Back when we were making Destination yeah. Truth, I always wanted to do, because we would do these paranormal shows, I always wanted to do, like, Saddam's haunted palaces. and it was, like, during the war. You know, they were yeah. like, no, like, you're not going to Iraq. We're not sending you to Iraq. So you know, some yeah. of them are things like that. And then some of them are just places that are really hard to get to.
Mm-hmm.
We did one this year that's going to be airing this season, which is up on our board for a really long time, which is this thing called the Dyatlov Pass. Do you know about this story?
Is that the one in Russia?
Yeah.
That's so the weird story where like the guys died,
yes.
but they were found naked or something like that.
This is like the scariest, you know, expedition gone wrong story ever. And it's one of the big mysteries of 20th century, you know, exploration stories. And we've wanted to do a piece on it for forever, but it is in a really remote place.
Yeah.
But this year we tackled it. So there's going to be a big two-part special coming up this season.
Wow. Is that Siberia or where?
It's in Siberia. So basically 60 years ago this year, 1959, a group of nine hikers in Siberia, nine young Russian hikers, these were like university students, they formed a sporting club. And as part of their kind of to get a merit badge kind of thing, they had to go do this kind of hiking cross-country skiing expedition into the Ural Mountains. Now, these are people that live in Siberia. They're really capable. This is not like if you dumped you and me in Siberia, right? Like these are folks who – these are Russians too. These are – right? 1959 Russian kids. Like these are pretty hardcore.
Yeah, they're no cream puffs.
Yeah, absolutely. So they went out on this hike and they were gone for about 10 days. They were supposed to be gone for a few weeks. They didn't come back. And they dispatched a search party, and they found their tent on this weird, exposed, kind of spooky peak, a place called Dead Mountain, because nothing grows on it. And they found their tent, and they were, none of them were in their tent. They found them all dead. There were nine of them. They were all within about a mile or so radius around the tent, all frozen to death, and none of them were wearing their warm weather clothes. None of them had their boots
weird.
On. I mean, they were in their socks.
Yeah.
Now, we went to this place. We went to right where their tent was. At the same night that they – we went in the same conditions they were in. It was almost 30 below.
Wow.
It was the coldest place I've ever been, and I've been to Antarctica. I mean, it was freezing. Beyond freezing. The idea that you would get out of a tent in that kind of weather with socks on is, like, impossible.
Bizarre.
So
– what could have happened?
They found no other footprints at the scene of people that were there. This place is really hard to get to. It's hard to imagine that somebody was there. There are slice marks in the tent that make it look like they had sliced their way out of it from the inside as though they were trying to get out quickly. And it's terrifying.
Yeah.
And they also had a lot of strange injuries beyond just being frozen to death, a broken rib here or there. You know, was it from the snow that had accumulated on top of them before investigators found them that crushed them? Was it something else?
Yeah.
It's a really, really haunting story. It's made even more haunting by the fact that they had 10 cameras with them. And there are like dozens and dozens of photographs from their expedition. And they all kept diaries. Each one of them is 10 diaries plus an 11th group diary. Or sorry, 9 diaries plus a group diary. They wrote in the diary every night. So you can really kind of get to know them and see their photos of their trip. It's a really haunting story. And so we went there on the 60th anniversary with investigators that are trying to solve the case and also trying to get the Russians to reopen the case and to look. There's a lot of case files that maybe have never been opened. And so for me, a really that's a bucket list story that we said no to for many years because it's just so hard to get to.
Yeah.
And this year we're going to tackle it.
Well, yeah, and I have to wonder, when you're doing a place like Russia or parts of Africa, South America, do you ever run into delicate situations with local politicians, bureaucrats? You ever get someone tries to shake you down or something like that? Give us $700 or you're going to get arrested.
We just, you know, that happens occasionally, not that often. I have to say, if I look at, I mean, I've been doing this for like 11 years of traveling between Expedition Unknown and Destination Truth. 99.99% of the time, people are pretty great everywhere. And in fact, my experience has been that the more quote-unquote dangerous, poor, destitute, you know, a place is, the nicer the people are. Yeah, occasionally you get the odd shakedown.
really? Or you get people that are hard. Does Discovery factor that into the budget? Or what?
No. Or you get places that are hard to work with. You know, we just had a pretty disappointing experience trying to film at Pompeii. You know, we're trying to film at Pompeii this year because they've been exploring a new quadrant of the city. I shouldn't even be saying this, but they're just kind of horrible to work with.
Really?
Just a shakedown.
Okay.
A lot of money. Yeah. A lot of money to come in and film at Pompeii.
Interesting.
And you sort of think, and to the point where we just scrapped it. We were like, this is too hard.
Wow.
It's too hard, you know, and you just think, this is a cultural treasure, this place. And, and you know, there's a lot of really new, amazing work that's being done there. And they just made it as hard as possible to work there. That's the exception. Yeah. It doesn't happen that often.
Yeah.
But that's also a place that's inundated with media requests.
Right.
And so, you know, like I'm not, you know, look, I get it. You know, they probably have film crews there every day of the year if you didn't have some systems over it.
Now, how many countries have you been to by now?
I believe I'm at 109.
109, over 100. Wow.
Not that I'm counting every day.
What's the best and worst?
Oh, best and worst. First of all, that's a
is that a long list on each end?
No, I mean, look, best is different categories, right, of best. Uh-huh. Just there are places in the world where you get off the plane and you sort of immediately say to yourself, I could live here. Mm-hmm. I love this place. And that's different for everybody. I love Southeast Asia, Vietnam, Cambodia, Thailand. I love it. Every time I get off the plane, I'm happy. I love it there. I love the people. I love the food. I love the culture. I love the smells. I just think it's the greatest. Other people get off the plane in Ireland and go, I want to live in Ireland, you know? But I love Southeast Asia. I could live there. I could live in Scotland. I'm a cold weather kind of guy.
You have Scottish blood? You're a redhead?
Somewhere. I have a lot of English blood, so I'm sure I got some Scottish blood in there. I could live in Scotland. I could live in Italy. Mm-hmm. Who could argue with the food in Italy?
Yeah, that's for sure.
I would die an early death, I'm sure, of heart disease. But I could live in Italy tomorrow. Worst is tough. I mean, I don't think somewhere
you're like, I don't have to ever go back to that place.
Yeah, like I'm not all that interested in like the Central Asian countries. Like I went to Kazakhstan. I was like, okay got it. You know, it's just not my jam. You know, but those places like Mongolia is a good example, right? Like. The people of Mongolia are amazing. Mm-hmm. The landscapes are amazing. But it's empty. It's a big landscape of emptiness, and the food is terrible.
Yeah.
It is. It's not great.
Yeah.
They're not working with a lot.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I can imagine. I've never had the diversity.
Right. Yeah. The diversity of ingredients is not huge.
Is that the place where they have the fire pit, too?
Yeah.
The giant burning pit.
Yeah.
That's like, is that the number one tourist attraction in Kazakhstan?
I've never been to it.
Okay.
But yeah, it's you know, like there are places where you talk about the food, Mongolia would be near the bottom of my list. You talk about incredible people, it'd be near the top.
Interesting.
You know, because these are people who, they're just the most hardcore, these nomadic, you know, capable, hardcore people that have been surviving out on this, you know, this landscape that's just so seems barren, but they make everything out of it. You know? So worst is a tough category for me.
Okay.
I don't think there's been a single place I've ever been where I thought, oh, there was no value in coming here, you know, because, you know, anything different is interesting. I mean, there's cities that I don't love. I don't love Manila in the Philippines. Mm-hmm. Port-au-Prince in Haiti is a tough town, you know?
Yeah.
I went to Haiti and we drove up to the northern coast of Haiti and it's stunning. It's just beautiful, you know?
Yeah.
And the people, Haitians, were just so thrilled that people were there. And so, you know, it's tough. It's like there's places I wouldn't necessarily go to for my next vacation.
Mm-hmm.
But I, you know, I love to travel. Yeah, I love to experience new things. So I'm kind of game for anything.
Yeah. And do you have any travel essentials that you always pack with you?
Yeah, so my travel essentials are a good camera. You know, I have a 5D that I travel around with. I'm a big Canon 5D.
Now, is that digital or is that old school?
It's digital.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
I'm in the digital revolution. Yeah. I have a guy on my crew that shoots film all the time, and I respect him, but I like the instant gratification of looking over my shots. And
well, it's risky, too, with film and going through security and stuff.
I know. Yeah. But and if you miss the shot and you're on the other side of the planet and you got one take at it, it's a heartbreaker.
Yeah.
I always have a good camera. I always bring a good notebook. I always have a Moleskine journal. It's really hard to remember to journal and to write and to do that kind of stuff. I'm just like everybody else, I forget to do it a lot of the time when I travel, but it's way more impactful to look back on your writing than it is photos.
Yeah. I always want to do that too, but I'm terrible at it.
Me too. It takes, because at the end of the day, you just don't want to do it. But boy, if you can look back on something you've written, it brings you back to a place so much more vividly than a photo.
So true.
Because you're in your head, you know? Yeah. So I always have that. The usuals, you know, I got to have an iPhone in there and my music and usually have a laptop because I'm working.
Yeah. Metal detector.
Yeah, metal
detector. You have a metal detector in your hand just about,
exactly.
I think, 50% of the time you're on screen.
Yeah, good boots, a good headlamp.
Yeah, okay.
You know, boots and a headlamp are pretty essential.
Yeah.
And then usually a small bag of of medication in case the food goes sideways and things like that. You know, everybody on my show gets sick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good advice. Well, before we go, I just wonder, I mean, we kind of talked about what your white whale is in the crypto world. Do you have some kind of a relic that is the Holy Grail for you? Or maybe it is the Holy Grail. I don't know.
Well, yeah, the Holy Grail
would
be
die
nice
to find.
Yeah. Is there one artifact more than any other? I think, you know, it's not necessarily an artifact, but I'm obsessed with Amelia Earhart. Mm-hmm. I'm obsessed with the story of her trans world flight, and obsessed with the fate of her Electra aircraft. I think if I could haul anything up out of the depths, it would be that plane.
Yeah, I was just reading that. I think Bob Ballard, who found the Titanic, is now doing an expedition. And
Ballard
there were
and
some old
or...
photos that they found that look like it could be parts from that plane.
Yeah, Ballard and Nat Geo are doing a project together. It's very much focused around an island called Nicomoraro out in the Pacific. I'm not in the camp of people that's totally convinced that, that Nicomoraro
is. Why not?
I don't know. It's to me, it feels like a long shot. There's a group called Tiger, led by a guy named Rick Gillespie, that has been really focused on Nicomoraro for a long time. We interviewed Rick when we did a show on Earhart a number of years ago. He's amazing. I think his group's really interesting. They're really passionate about the idea that she died as a castaway on Nicomoraro. They have found interesting bits and bobs on the island that circumstantially might lead you to believe that there was a castaway there.
Okay.
However, I think a lot of things wash up on islands. A lot of things end up in funny places. And I just think the probability is that she ditched at sea in the middle of nowhere after running out of fuel.
Interesting.
So if I was a betting man, I would say that plane is very deep at the bottom of the ocean. But I'll never say never. And I certainly want to be wrong. I hope them. I wish them the best.
Yeah, I think that was your first episode. So maybe you'll revisit that one of these days.
Hey, I would love to. And if she's on Nicomoraro, she's someone who, if we could find remains of that plane and you could loft that up in the Smithsonian, you know, what an absolute amazing
soccer
way to...
ball with like a face on it, written on it with a marker. Yeah,
you know, she's such a pioneer, and to be able to offer some closure to that story would be unbelievable.
Definitely. Well, one more time, season 7 of Expedition Unknown is currently airing Wednesdays at 8/9 Central on Discovery. Josh Gates, thanks for talking to me. It's fun.
Thanks, man. All the best. It was a pleasure.
Thanks again to Josh Gates for coming on the show. Expedition Unknown airs Wednesdays at 9 p.m. Eastern on Discovery Network. Keep up with Josh at joshuagates.com or on Twitter at Joshua Gates. Hey folks, got a case of the post-podcast munchies? Well, White Castle sliders from the grocery store are perfect for conquering those craves. Made with 100% beef patties on a bed of steamed grilled onions, it takes just a few minutes to make your very own mouth-watering, one-of-a-kind tasting White Castle sliders. Hey, I've been craving their cheese sliders ever since I went to White Castle in Chicago many years ago. And I'm happy to report that their store-bought sliders are the real deal. The same authentic White Castle experience, just like being in the restaurant. And for me, there's no better late-night treat than a few cheese sliders before bed. So get crave-conquering and go to whitecastle.com/kick to get $1 off the purchase of any 4- or 6-pack White Castle sliders. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickassNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.